This is Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. John Akins. Today is 1 February 2016. I am in Lubbock, Texas on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Akins is joining me by telephone from his home in Washington State. Mr. Akins, to begin this interview, I'd like to get some background biographical information from you. Can you tell me when you were born and where?
I was born June 8, 1947 in Helena, Montana.
And what were your parents' names?
John Crichton Akins and Mary Catherine Immel, maiden name, Akins.
What did your parents do for a living there?
My father was a trained civil engineer, worked for Carson Construction Company, I think, and then after a while, we moved out to Seattle when I was young, around 2 years old, I guess, with the family, and he worked for a general contractor, became their estimator, working in Alaska for a while we were in Seattle, and then moved on to Tacoma, Washington for another general contractor as their estimator and became their kind of go-to guy there for that contractor, building bridges, roadways, some buildings.
And what about your mother?
My mother, I guess, had worked as a teller in a bank and then was a homemaker until around the 60s, late 60s, when most of the five kids were grown. I have a younger brother, Ron, who's 14 years younger than me. So, and at that point, she wanted to work. She worked in a daycare or a preschool, and also did a lot of volunteer work with members of the Catholic parish that she belonged to. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that there were five children, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Now, you grew up, I guess, in the Seattle area. Can you tell me about your childhood growing up?
Yeah, grew up around the in the Montlake district, which is just on the edge of the University of Washington, on the other side of the canal that runs between Lake Washington, right past the Husky Stadium and the Elliott Bay and Beaver Town. That was a great neighborhood, a mix of blue collar and some professional. Had the University of Washington Arboretum, which is a huge arboretum, just two blocks away, and grew up running around, playing in the neighborhood, in our alley, and in the alley behind my friend's house, and into the arboretum. Got lost there one time when we roped the big Irish setter and followed the dog out, fortunately. Got home, didn't kill anybody, we were lost. But sold papers at the Husky Stadium, TI papers, game days, and got in free at halftime to watch players who eventually ended up in, did they go to the Rose Bowl? I don't know. But anyway, so that was great growing up, you know, a lot of just riding bikes around, running around the neighborhood, exploring the health sciences complex just across the canal on the UW campus, and running elevators up and down, and learning to spit off the Mount Lake Bridge, and a little bit of Cub Scouts there, and then my family moved about 30 miles south to Tacoma when I was 11. So new neighborhood, big, lived on in a house on a hill overlooking Puget Sound. So we weren't part of Till Hill. We were at the foot of that, well, Till Hill. tell all the doctors with swimming pools and the guns in the backyard. We were on what was part of the old Sam 6th Avenue tomato farm. Homesteaded by the neighbor, the Perrys, his extended family, including the Wallmakers. And Mr. Perry worked it, and they sold part of it, and we had a house right next door. So we had lots of open, three or four lots of open ground to play around and for. People came down the hill, walked through our yard and through the empty lots to the local swimming pool, including a Kay Hall, who was an Olympic gold medalist.
Is
in
that right?
The 60s, probably 64 or 68, something. Yeah, so and then junior high school, a big high school, 3,000 students, more than 700 in my graduating class.
Wow.
So I was looked at by our wrestling coach and football coach, but because he evaluated everybody at PE and called me asking how much I weighed, about 88 pounds, so he told me to get up to 120 so that I could turn out. But I graduated at about 110.
Okay.
So I was strong, but I was not big enough. They wouldn't let you play unless you weighed 120. And just, you know, a big, big enrollment. And so I always regretted I didn't grow up in some small town or small high school so I could trade all of it.
Yeah. And what year did you graduate high school?
1965.
In 1965. Tell me about the world as you understood it in terms of the Cold War. What is going on as you're growing up out there on the West Coast? How did the Cold War impact your life, and what did you know about what was going on?
Well, I was on a lake in Western Washington, Lawrence Lake or something, the night that Sputnik was coming over, and I was in a rowboat with my dad, and him being an engineer is pretty interested in this stuff, and we watched the first Sputnik go across the horizon at night. So it was serious. I got serious about school because I noticed all the students around me in my new school, my new home, and everything. We're all pretty serious students, so they became my buddies. So I emulated them, and I got serious about school. But I was a good memorizer, and I was a good kid. So I think I did well in school on those traits. And we saw John Kennedy. He came to Cheney Stadium, which is a AAA baseball stadium. We got out of school to see him make an appearance there. So it was kind of, everybody looked up at him, and I remember when he was assassinated, I was in roll room, the 20-minute period before first period, where they take attendance and have announcements. And I was very serious kid about occupation. I studied the New York Life book of occupations that listed all the occupations, what they did, how much money they made, and what was required education-wise for various occupations. And so the emphasis all of a sudden became on the Kennedy office on science and math. We had to catch up with the Russians. Also fitness. John Kennedy instituted this fitness program in public schools, and that was right up my alley. I love playing sports and running around chasing people with a ball or getting chased or whatever. And I was shorter than the average, so by high school I had bought myself a set of weights, and I just loved playing sports and working. Started out mowing lawns and cleaning houses, and then I got my first job at 15 at Albertson's grocery store, 8 hours a week cleaning the produce department and the meat department. And I said I want to be a boss boy to my manager, and they thought I was too small. You know, by then they promoted me to boss boy. So then I didn't turn out for wrestling because I felt very important having a job after school. Made me feel big, and my mother had taught me how to keep track of money in a ledger, and I discovered that when you keep track of it, you watch it grow because you're more careful about spending it, and you kind of like having $200 in an old Great Falls bank, a Great Falls money bag, and paying for my own stuff, tennis, skiing. And so I was serious about going to college and getting a good occupation and the American dream, which a few years later I had disavowed because I failed accounting 220, second quarter accounting, my sophomore year at the University of Washington. I only had two tests, midterm and final. I had a C- on the midterm. I was struggling. I went to the teaching assistant, a grad student, said, "I don't get this book." And he said, "I don't get this book either." So there's a new book, new textbook. Anyway, when I failed the accounting, so I got no credit. And without those three credits, I was one or two credits shy of staying on track to graduate in 4 years. So I lost my 2S student deferment, and then I had to run around and figure out what to do.
And what direction do you go? You talked about the student deferment. Obviously, that was keeping you, I don't want to say protected from the draft, but out of the draft as you're going to college. But now now that is gone, you can do a number of different things. What did you want to do?
Well, when I was 14, I finally decided I wanted to be a physical therapist.
Okay.
Then my dad said, "No, that's a woman's work." So then I thought, "Oh, I'll try to be a medical school." And after a quarter or two of chemistry and physics, with physics I got, chemistry I didn't get, I realized my first quarter I went from, you know, honor student in high school to like a 194. So I switched to building technology and architecture, which was sort of in between lower campus, the sciences, and upper campus, liberal arts. But with the then, of course, during my first year in college, I met Joni Weitzel, and we dated, and I met her twin brother, Jimmy Weitzel. And Jimmy having picked a major, and when I got out of the service, I ran into him, and he was finishing up his degree in physical therapy and became the Seahawks' first trainer.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Oh, damn. I should have stuck to my plan.
Yeah. When you're
because at that time, there was very few men in that field, and they were, just knocking it down and getting good jobs like that.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, in 98 or so, I went back to school after I was let go from my job with the Washington State Conservation Commission. Great job. My boss got pancreatic cancer and died. And they hired the wrong guy. They didn't hire a local guy to replace him. They hired a lobbyist from D.C., and he was a micromanager. And you don't micromanage a former Marine infantryman / counterinsurgency guy who figures out how to get the job done without supervision, because fucked up supervision can get you killed. But when you come back into the, what we used to call the real world, back to the United States, that's trying to take the hill, get out of my way, I know what I'm doing, doesn't work with some managers.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me have you take me back to your the end of your time there at the University of Washington. What did you plan on doing once your student deferment was no longer available to you? Are you looking at the military now?
Well, not right away. I got that letter. It was the end of sophomore year, but I had just found a job, a construction job, union job, working in an underground 52-inch diameter water pipe, replacing the old wooden one with wooden staves and steel bands, which went under the Tolt River, and so I got that job. I kept that job, what I'd done while I was working was just before I went to work that summer, that spring, I actually worked construction a little bit on a project on campus, which is not quite as big as the intramural building and facility and was at Fort Worth, but it was a good little job for a while. And while I was doing that, I ran around. I went to the naval base nearby in Seattle. It's still operating, a small park on the lake, and inquired with the CBs, and they said, "Yeah, you got some construction background? Sure, sign up." And they said, "How long do you have to serve?" 3 years. Oh, I wanted to just do the minimum so that I could get it done and get on with my life, back to school, or that's off the plan. Have the GI Bill, which turned out to be minuscule, niggardly, nothing, $130 a month for books, tuition, board, everything. And then I tried, reserves had a 3-year waiting list. So I was walking on University Avenue, and there was a Naval Marine recruiting station, and they had this new, said, 2-year program that you could enlist for just 2 years, and you could have delayed entry for a couple months. I thought, oh, I'll check this out, because I can keep working all summer, and I'll be able to, and then go in the fall, September, instead of back to school. And so I walked in there and I asked the guy, now if I sign up, if I'm volunteering, will I get to pick what I'm going to be? You know, I thought lifeguard in Hawaii or something. And he said, yeah, right. If you do, you get this, what they call the green shit, and you can pick the top three. And, he showed me that, and there's all kinds of jobs that look safe. And I said, okay. And then after working that summer in that underground water pipe, I was ready to be inducted and I showed up at the induction center in the section of just part of downtown Seattle called Inner Bay. It was a big old warehouse, and the room was full. There must have been a couple hundred guys, and they lined us up alphabetically, and then they started the show where they were inducting people, and saw this, turns out to be a Marine. He comes out, strides up, goes, you, and takes the first five of us. And it was, you've been inducted into the Marine Corps. And I said, oh, wait, I already signed up. I forgot what they called the program. Early entry to your, and he said, shut the fuck up. Get in here. I think I saved the six guys from getting, because he could have taken me and another one if he had to have five for his quota or whatever. But anyway, so there I was, and then end of September, about September 27th, when I would have been starting my junior year of college, I was reporting at boot camp at MCRD, Marine Corps Recruiting Depot in San Diego.
Okay. And this was September of 1967.
Right.
Can you take me through your experience there at basic training? What was that like?
Well, it was a lot of fun for me. I was an old guy. I had just turned 19 or 20, probably 20, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I owned the obstacle course, and I scored the highest in the all four physical training tests, you know, which could have been a stripe right out of boot camp. So I love that part. I actually love the drilling part. Once everybody got it together and you could just be marching. I had been in the marching band in high school for one or two quarters, first year of high school. So that's kind of neat marching. I even liked that, the drilling on the parade ground and the marching, and how once it all came together, how synchronized it was, and how some of the moves you were doing were pretty cool, like I forget what they call those halftime shows where they do stuff. And so the schooling part was pretty easy for me. The black humor and the fear, the fine line between fear and humor that the DIs were doing was brilliant. You saw a little bit of it in the movie Full Metal Jacket.
Sure.
That was an action. But our three guys were, luckily being short, they had the four shortest guy at the end of the platoon from front to back. And so the four of us back there, we had a good time. We would do the basketball weave while we were marching in formation because they couldn't see us. You know, the drill instructors were up to the front and they didn't see what we were. Or somebody would do a right flank, and the inside guy would give the outside guy a shove as we pivoted to the right or to the left, and that was fun. But then other DIs from on the parade ground saw us, and then I ended up doing squat thrusts forever and ever, and that was harder than push-ups.
Yeah.
But so made it through Marine Corps boot camp, so I was okay. ITR, I was kind of disappointed how loosey-goosey the Marines were becoming. I was getting in fights. Any time that the gung-ho, the young and dumb, full of cum world, they were in this Hollywood mode, right? And I had been through fraternity hazing. So the hazing part, although it could get scary, I saw the DI stomp a guy's leg on the concrete cat of the latrine and break his leg, and I had gotten hit in the back of the head with a full magazine of 7.76 rounds on the M14 firing range by a disgruntled range instructor. You know, I've seen stars and stuff like that. So, but so you had to be careful, but it was hard not to just keep from laughing at some of the antics that the DIs would do, and unless they got violent, you know. I mean, sometimes they did, but they were the black humor, I guess you call it, or the scaring people to get them into shape. Or, you know, it was scary when they take a M14 rifle barrel and tap it against a guy's forehead enough to cut the skin. And, but the other times when they just get into somebody's shit was hilarious. And they, you know, so I think I was a bit older, and it, like I said, been exposed to a couple weeks of hazing or so. And then ITR was, they just rushed us through. It's like, okay, did everybody get a chance to orient the map and shoot an asthma? Sir, the private didn't get a chance. Shut up. You know, off to the next thing. So, the training was okay, but then I went deaf on the M14 range, and so I was worried. I was worried about how am I gonna creep through the jungle, and you know, because we were told about what it was about, and that you had to be stealthy and stuff like that, and rely on your senses. So I was very concerned when I was getting on, boarding the flight at Travis Air Force Base. My last stop, you check in orders and stuff, and the guy goes, the clerk goes, why are you going to Vietnam? You had orders to go to language school in Monterey, California for at least 3 months.
Hmm.
And I went, because I'd scored very high on language proficiency, I guess. And you know, that was the first I learned about that. That was like next, you know. And I'm on the plane, wondering why am I not in language school? But as it turned out, I was a rifleman and in Marine infantry, and I landed at Da Nang from Okinawa. I remember letting out a deep breath as I got off the phone and going, 13 months, I wonder if I'll make it.
Hmm. What did you know about Vietnam once you finished ITR? You know that you're going to be going. And you mentioned that someone had, some had been talking to you about, you know, what to expect in Vietnam. What did you know about what was going on over there?
Well, I knew this from reading Time Magazine. When you're totally isolated in boot camp, but once you get out into ITR, you can get a weekend leave, to look at newspapers, stuff like that. I knew that Marines were taking 80% casualties. That's what started some fights in ITR, where these guys were all getting gung-ho, couldn't wait to get over there and kill Kong and say, look, Marine infantry is taking 80% casualties. For those of you that didn't pay attention in math, for every 10 Marines, 8 are getting hit, killed, or wounded. And they said, were you a communist? And the fight, and jumped in, and then the fight was on.
Yeah.
I actually started a race riot in ITR on a different occasion.
Is that right? Can you tell me about that?
Well, we were getting toward the end of the day or something, and a drill instructor, or whatever they called them then, ITR instructor, infantry training regiment instructor, told me to go into the barracks and go to the duty officer's office and get something. I can't remember what. Probably some sheet of what's going on next or something. So I went to the barracks. Just a minute. I got to stop a sec here.
Okay, no problem.
A big black Marine, big guy, had just finished mopping the deck in the barracks, and I gotta go in here and hit the plane. He's back, and I got up, and I just bulldozed him and tackled him onto his back, and I was going to go for the throat, and then all of a sudden it just erupted into a blacks versus whites battle. Well, I kind of crawled away and watched it all, and the MPs coming and swinging clubs and putting it down.
Now, were there, must have been, I guess, given the way that this took place, some underlying racial tensions there at ITR. Did you find this to be the case?
Well, you know, I don't know. I didn't really see that. You didn't see anything like that in boot camp. I didn't see any racial tension in ITR. Myself, Gene Fulber, Marvin Cohn, as kids, 10-year-olds, were the only white guys in the East Madison YMCA in Seattle, because that was as you got further away from the UW campus, going south, it got into from Montlake District that I grew up, a little blue collar mix, some professional, into the low socioeconomic area, a lot of blacks, the Central District. And the Central District is still the Central District, but it's being regentrified. So anyway, I didn't notice any racial tension, because you didn't get out of line any way, shape, or form, or you were inviting a beating or a squat thrust forever and ever.
Right.
And in ITR, I didn't notice it. I don't know if it was before that incident. It might have been after that incident. But it was a weekend, and we were able to make phone calls. And so there was just a couple, maybe there was three phone booths, one each in a row. And I got in line, and I sold my place in line for a quarter until I had this huge wad of change in both pockets. And then I went on up to the phone booth and went in and was calling this girl I'd met before I left for boot camp, who was from Philadelphia. I was talking to her on the East Coast and feeding quarters, and I had about three or four left on the tray under the phone. And you know, the calls, you got interrupted saying, "You have 2 minutes, you have 1 minute." Well, right about then, the stud Marine, who was the platoon commander or something, right? He was a guy from Chicago. He was a very dark black Negro, an African American, perfect white flashing teeth. He was a poster Marine, and he was very stout and buff, and he could walk with that Marine drilling, six to the front, swing your hand, six to the front, three to the rear, lean back and strut. And he came up to the phone book and said, "Hey, get out." And I put my hand against the door and told him to be quiet. And then I kept talking, because I just had a few more, probably less than a minute. And he was getting animated, get out in front of a, 200 guys. And I wouldn't let him in. And then when I came out, you know, I sort of felt some of that pent up, maybe rage that the Marine Corps is trying to instill.
Mm-hmm.
And I just got right in his face, you know, nose to nose, and told him off, and he backed down.
Mm.
You know, and everyone was afraid of him. You know, he was from Chicago. He was black. He was very buff, and handsome, and very confident Marine, and he backed down. And boy, then after that, I was king of the hill.
Mm.
And then shortly after that, I was noticing guys were looking at me, sizing me up, and going, "I take him." And so then I was getting into more confrontations. But before anything could change, we were on our way to the next stop. But I didn't really hear anything about whites disrespecting blacks or blacks, you know, trying to hose over whites, or I didn't see anything like that.
Yeah.
I think that the Marine Corps, they keep you too tight and too in fear of screwing up. You could end up in motivation platoon, or you could end up in correctional custody. You could end up doing boot camp all over again, and or getting beat up. So I bounced off a set of lockers a few times by my DI, but it was all noise. You know, how a row of lockers against in a Quonset hut against the wall.
Mm-hmm.
They thought I had purposely tube the officer candidate test, and so they were asking me about that and knocking me around. This is all noise. It didn't hurt me. It was actually kind of funny. It was a black DI, but I had a lot of respect for him, and he actually respected me. He had, can't remember his name, but he was one of the few Marines, before they made it easier, to score the maximum 500 out of 500 points on the physical training test.
Mm.
That's a rare thing. Now all these college athletes that are in OCS or something are maxing it, but it's changed tests. I looked it up, and the highest, my first test out of four was 410. My last test was 480. So he had respect for me. We all respected him. The chief drill instructor, Rudy, could get crazy. You could see it in his eyes, and he could really get on somebody's case. "What are those zits doing on your face? I'll take his ballpoint pen, and I'll take them out of there if they're on your face." He was not joking, really. I mean, because you could see, you know, that this guy was seriously pissed off. And somebody, you know, because they want their platoon to win the honor as honor platoon based on scores, and, you know, you don't want a doofus in your platoon, you don't want whatever. So, but I never saw any kind of racial overtones or undertones or at all.
Well, let me ask you this. You're in the Marine Corps. You know that you're going to Vietnam. What was your family's reaction to your impending trip to Vietnam?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think my dad could tell that I was a bit concerned, and we actually went over to see my 8th grade history teacher, who also had a shoe store, managed a shoe store, and so it was summertime or something. Anyway, we went over there on, maybe it was a weekend, and to talk to him, because he had been in the Navy. And, you know, I told him, I said, "Well, I got orders for Vietnam." And he, you know, and he went, "Oh, make sure you have guys you can trust that will back you up. I think you might even say big guys, you know. And so that was like, okay, that's some good advice, but why? And then my main concern was that, you know, I was temporarily deaf after the week on the M14 firing range. I was concerned about that. But, you know, there was, when I expressed that concern to some in transit period, transit platoon or company, an officer, I told him, I said, I'm not sure about going to Vietnam and being in the infantry when I couldn't hardly hear after the rifle range, and he blew that off. And then I got on the plane a couple days later and ended up in Con Tien, which is right up near the DMZ.
So you come into town in Da Nang, or into country in Da Nang, and then they immediately ship you up to Con Tien?
Next day or so.
And what unit was this?
It was Echo 2-1, so Echo okay. Company, 2nd Battalion, 1st Marine Division.
And you are a 0311 infantry rifleman, and you're headed to Con Tien. Tell me about your first experiences there in Vietnam. What was that like for you to come into the unit, to be in that part of the world, seeing what's going on in the war zone? Give me your experiences of your earliest times in Vietnam.
Well, we got off the chopper, and somebody met us and walked us into Con Tien, which had been really hosed over by the NVA, just earlier, so the previous months or weeks. And, it looked like a typical Marine base that I later learned after being in Khe Sanh. Well, Khe Sanh looked worse. It looked like it was a landfill with just everything all busted up, and you couldn't stay above ground very long in Khe Sanh. And I guess it was, looking back, I've read a lot, reading about Con Tien, and I meet an officer who tells one of his squad leaders, get these two, or I think there was three of us, get these three guys some high and tight haircuts. And I thought, why do we need to get high and tight haircuts here? And I thought that was silly. And then he told us, he pointed out in the distance, those are the Khô Rock Mountains. And that's where the NVA is dug in. And we're getting to be up in there. And so, you know, when the shit hits, it's sort of like a football game. You know, you're a little worried, but after that first hit, you get hit, and then you're ready to go. Well, that's what it's like. And I thought, that's ridiculous, comparing it to a football game, you know. As it turns out, he was kind of right. But so then the next morning we go out on a patrol, and we get out of the wire just a little bit, and there's some dead NVA, and I look at this one face down, and he is big. He's over 6 feet. He is a big guy. And so it was, oh yeah, Chinese. And I did know that in China, the ones from the north, I don't know which is, whether it was the ones from the north or the ones from the south, but the ones, let's say they're from the north, they're really big, and something like that. And so I saw this guy, his back was still smoking from being hit by a Huey gunship the day before or the morning of or something. And then I watched this Black Marine standing on the kind of upside of a bomb crater, and he just opened up on that guy, opened up on the corpse, and I thought, his chest was all puffed out and everything. Well, he just unloaded a full magazine on a corpse, and I think he might have been another fucking new guy, because that was what I, my assessment was, wow, he must be a fucking new guy. And what is he, Hollywood, you know, what, been watching too many movies or something. And then we went on, and I was carrying a lot of gun ammo. I'm a new guy. I was just loaded down with my stuff, and then two boxes of gun ammo. And it was very hot. I'm standing out here in the Pacific Northwest. It's damp and gray and probably 40 degrees, but it feels cold. And so I remember I set the gun ammo down on the trail for somebody behind to take a turn on it. And I got kind of told off about doing that. You don't ever leave ammo on the trail. So I didn't leave it where anybody would find it but the guy behind me. He told me that. And then, but another one, he saw a Marine ask me for water. So I gave him some water. And he came up to me, kind of took me aside and said, look, don't give your water away. You're going to need that. And he was right about that, too. But later, as you get tight with people, you share everything. Mm-hmm. But he was just schooling a new guy and giving me some good advice to be careful about water. He told me, you'll be out here for weeks and months, and you don't know when you'll come across water, and if they can't resupply you, you're in a hump.
You go out on this first patrol. Can you tell me about the climate? Can you tell me about, and you mentioned a little bit of the heat. Can you tell me about the environment that you're in? What's that doing to you?
Well, I mean, I'm just still kind of in this fog of what am I into and how am I going to make it? And I was just following the guy ahead of me, looking around at this terrain, which is reminded me of Eastern Washington, which is agrarian. Our state is split north to south by the Cascade Mountain Range. Puget Sound area, commercial, industrial, and the eastern side is farmland and rolling hills, bare, you know, there where you can't see very far for the trees or hills. It's flat. Well, this was kind of flat and kind of open, and lots of bomb craters. I saw the size of them, the weather, it was hot. I wasn't used to the weather that was hot, you know. A few days later, another Marine with more experience said, are you taking salt tablets? You need to take salt tablets and drink a lot of water, you know, because that was why, you know, I was probably a little, I wasn't white, but I was, sweating profusely. I was looking weak, I guess, or wimpy or something like that. And he was warning me about drinking enough water. And so I was just taking this all in and trying to watch guys that seemed to know what they were doing. And as it, day by day, it was just shortly after I got to Compton that we left on an operation where we spent the next 2 or 3 months, 2.5, 3 months, maybe at least, working our way up to the DMV, along the DMV, up and down these hills, and then to get into Quezon to reinforce Ace Quezon, because TET had been going on for about 2 weeks. So it was the hardest thing I'd ever done, was climbing those hills with about 50 or 60 pounds and walking point a lot. As always, you hear Aikens up, come down the column and down the line, and then I would go up to the front. And some of the terrain was so thick, you could only bash your way through it. You couldn't even swing a machete. And that was, it was just brutally, physically hard. And then during that period of time, there was things going on that were, you know, I saw a new guy fall out with heat exhaustion. He'd only been with us a couple days, got choppered in, and we're pumping up this hill, and it's not, we're not bashing our way through, but it's hard going, and he fell out. And I've written a poem about this called The Spinner. And so he's in our squad, and so with the squad is 10 guys, but actually there's only about four of us. That's how it is. I never saw a full complement in the Marine Corps. They were taking too many casualties. But anyway, he's on the ground, and we're pouring our water on him and trying to cool him down, and the corpsman comes up, Navy corpsman, and he's trying to give him, I think he put an IV into him and asked for a medevac. And some sergeant came up. I noticed he was, I didn't know where he was from, an other platoon, the platoon behind us, I think. Or he was maybe part of our platoon. Anyway, he came up and said, get him on his feet, was kicking at the guy. Mm-hmm. And the corpsman is kneeling down, trying to get a medevac. And he said, I need an emergency medevac. And the guy said, no way. No medevac, get him on his feet. Well, he died right there. Well, and we had emptied our canteens on him, and he died.
Wow.
And then three of us had to take turns humping his corpse. Someone would take my pack, and I'd get this long, lanky guy and humping. And when we got to the top of the hill, was again, I was carrying him. When we finally got onto off the rise, and we got into a flat area, and I just went forward a little ways, threw him off me, rolled down onto my back, and just said to myself, just walk up and shoot me right in the forehead. So it was a combination of the strain of humping this corpse, but mainly of him basically, to me, being murdered by some gung-ho John Wayne type.
That must have made a tremendous impact on you to see the value that was placed, or maybe perhaps the lack of value that was placed on this individual in the midst of these difficult circumstances.
Yeah, well, a few days later, or maybe it was a week later, I don't know, another incident, but maybe even worse, was that the two guys I was watching, because the word is, every day you dig in, every night you dig in the morning you get up and you move out, and you're going literally where I would get down and just lay my rifle down and rush into this and bash into this foliage, you know, just try to break trail. I later, years later, 20 years later, I read about a guy saying, yeah, three of us, we can get through this, but we just take turns getting in a three-point stance and just hike and just bash our way through. So I felt like, yeah, I know what you're talking about. But so I have been watching Miller and White, because these were two guys that I found out they had about 5 months in. So they're very experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And I've watched them. Every chance if I ever was around, I watched how they operated, what they were doing, how they were doing it. And one day, we got hit, we got contact, and guy in my little fire team, so that's three of us, the contact happened, it's daylight, happened up ahead of us a little bit. Randy grabbed me, and we were at the edge of on the lip of a bomb crater, and he said, we better watch here. We better stay back here and watch this, you know. And I could hug him. I went, oh, thank God. Yeah, let's stay back here. Well, Miller and White were up ahead, and they went, this was told to me by another guy, he's going, whoa, they just went into that cave and they shot two guys and dragged them out, you know, and stuff like that. Well, and I thought, yeah, okay, well, so then a few days later, I happened to be Walken Point. I'm ahead of Miller and White, so I'm feeling really good about this, you know, because I got the two guys that I know what they're doing, and they're right behind me. And then all of a sudden, you hear this screaming sound, like a freight train coming, and boom, and I'm knocked onto my face. And I turn around, and then there's nothing. And I turn around, and I go back up 10, 20 feet, and there's Miller and White laying in a crater, just chunks of meat. And it was a short round. They said it was a short round. It was our own artillery. So a mortar, 81 mortar probably. And nobody saw, I thought, you know, first I'm shocked there. I'm looking at just chunks of meat side by side in this crater. And I'm shocked. I can't believe this. It was our own mortar. That word came down real quick. They said it was, and I said, well, who's going to, you know, I was trying to think, I didn't know what I exactly said, I was trying to think, who's going to answer for this? Who's going to pray for this? This is, you know, it was a mistake probably. Was it really a short round, or did someone call in? Did somebody fire on our coordinates, not the coordinates that were ahead of us? Because they would recon by fire that way. So this guy said, oh, that's the NOM, man. It's fucked. And everybody was just very nonchalant about it. I just couldn't believe how it was like, so what? Keep going. That shocked me. I think that shocked me worse than a guy not getting a medevac. Yeah, so then on we go, onward to get to Quezon.
Is this, do you... I should ask you, how do you deal with this? You mentioned that someone said, hey, that's just the NOM, so you pick up and move on. Mm-hmm. But the first time you experience something like this, you know, you don't know that it's the NOM, and that's the way, you know, things go sometimes. How do you process and deal with this initial time?
Well, I remember just thinking, there's no way I'm going to make it here. I mean, this is, you know, and but this was initially, I was just, mostly it was like fear, I guess, or the realization that it will be hard to survive 13 months of this. And so I was kind of, you know, I want to say in a funk, but I was just, it was just day after day after day of this. And just that how hard it was, how dangerous it was, and it seemed like it, people getting blown away by our own guy, a guy getting dying of heat exhaustion. Yeah, he went into heat stroke. That's fatal. I knew that from Boy Scouts first aid and other first aid classes, you know, that shouldn't happen. So it was like, this is a world of shit, and it's going to be really hard to make 13 months. It's an incremental thing. You shut down emotionally. You start to adapt to violence, and you kind of become an automaton. I was having trouble also because what happened later on, this is still trying to get to Quezon, you know, or working down, Aiken's up, I go up, I'm walking point, and I'm doing it like they kind of showed us in ITR, you know, have a little stick, and keep it in front of you, and just brush the ground, and see if you hit a booby trap, or I mean, you know, if you find a string across the trail or something, that's a booby trap, you know. So, and I was being very careful, I was watching, scanning, and moving slowly to be stealthy, and I had that stick, and I'm going along, and my squad leader, he was a guy that would kick you in your boot sole to wake you up in the morning of your walk or get ready to go, Randy. And, you know, I told him, don't ever kick me in the sole of my boot to wake me up. Just wake me up, you know. And anyway, so Randy comes, striding up, pushes me aside, you know, I'm too slow, and walks into an ambush. Wow! You know, and he's down screaming. So all of a sudden, all this fire is going out and coming in. Branches are fluttering down. I mean, the check, you know, and I call up, you know, and I crawl my way up. I work my way up to him. He flops on his back. I see blood all over his hands, so I get out of saddle dressing and I start wrapping his hand, and then I realize his shoulder is only on by a shred of flesh. So then I kind of do the life-saving grab. I grab him around the chest, pinned his arm and to me, and slithered my way back, hauling him back. He's screaming. I'm trying to tell him to shut up. They're tracking fire. That, you know, the branches and leaves are fluttering down over us, and I get him back, and it's done. Firefight's over. I get him back to where the guys are firing, online firing and everything. And we're in a canopy now area. So he's screaming for morphine, and I say something inappropriate, like, he's screaming about the pain. I said, well, I tried to say, you know, if you're feeling pain, you're alive, you know, something like that. Or, you know, it's okay. And that didn't go well with his friend. Hmm. And right away, I was starting to get criticized, you know, about, or, you know, like, I think I was also sick. I, like, was coughing up stuff lying out, sitting a lot, and just, why do you always sit? And stuff like that. And I said, oh, I got sinus problem or something. And they were, I realized they were not happy that that was Randy and not me.
Hmm.
And so you just, as you go along, you start to adapt. And what was I was learning that these guys in charge may not be the best leadership.
Yeah.
So I was learning that. And I was learning, I was coming to terms with the fact that I might not make it. And then finally, one day I got some mail and I saw a picture of my youngest brother. So he was 7 at the time, and he had built a low hurdle in the backyard, and somebody caught him just as he was clearing that low hurdle, broomstick over 2 chairs or something. And I saw that and I said, I gotta get home. I gotta see this. And so I made up my mind then that I was gonna not give up, that I was gonna keep going. And then I started adapting to the violence. I started shutting down. And then the next thing that happened is you come to that line where if you cross over, you're going into the dark night. You are starting to groove on the excitement of town. Many run. They come to that line. They turn back and run. They shoot themselves in the palm of their hand. When they finally got the case on, the first night that I'm on radio watch, the guy just, so, you know, comes get me, takes me back, hands me the radio in the trench line in caisson, and says, you got to watch for 2 hours. So-and-so has a neck, wake him up in 2 hours. Here's the watch. Here's the radio. Okay, so I'm looking out, and I'm thinking I'm seeing eyes. You know, what I'm seeing is fireflies. I've never seen fireflies, but every once in a while, the night would kind of light up at the roof. And I thought it was through the eyes. And so I'm really spooked, and I'm really trying to focus, not stare, keep scanning the area. And then the radio comes on and says something like, blah, 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 SIDREP. And I go, what? And he goes, just say all secure negative contact. So I said, okay, all secure negative contact out. And a little bit later, so I'm watching, and I'm thinking, are these people creeping up on me? And then I realized, oh, those are fireflies. And then, or something. And then all of a sudden I hear this pow. And I look down to my right, down the trench, and I see a figure running at me. And I jump out of the trench, and I got my 16, and I'm ready to shoot. And I hear this, help, I'm hurt. Sounds like an American. It was another Marine in the bunker down the way, shot himself in the palm with a 45. And then later on, while we're still in caisson, he sends a postcard, I'm in Japan, I'm going to get a medical discharge. But there's a self-inflicted wound. And, I mean, somebody pulled me, I got interviewed by some officer, what happened? I said, well, I was on guard, I was on watch, and a figure ran at me, said he's hurt, and that's all I know. So he claimed he was cleaning his weapon, but other people said he'd been talking about doing this, and he's cleaning the weapon in the middle of the night. If you're sleeping, if you get a chance, you're sleeping.
Right. So different people deal with these kinds of pressures and strains differently, clearly, is what you're saying here.
All of these young Hollywood types, you know, I mean, they've been watching movie types. One was claiming he was homosexual. The guy shot himself through the palm of his hand. Oh, I'm in caisson, and I first found a bunker that nobody was using. You know, everybody was kind of crowded into this one big bunker, and they had built the Marines before, or somebody had built three-tiered wood, out of wood pallet racks, you know, so you could all three walls, you know, had two bunks or three bunks, and they'd crowd in there. Well, I found the bunker a little ways away. It was small. It was dank. And nobody was in it. It was empty. So I claimed it, and I put my stuff in there. And then I get on watch somewhere. I have to go on garbage patrol or something, and I come back, and there's a pile of shit there. You know, how come you don't play cards with us? I don't want anyone. I got tired of all, your mother wears combat boots and drives a beer truck. And, I gave your old lady $20 so she'd get off her back. And I got real tired of that real quick. And they didn't like playing cards. I would need a paperback. And so I cleaned that mess up. And, I had my own place. But the guys that were immediately working around me, in my little team of three of us, they liked me. And one of them was a black guy, Rose. I can't remember his name. His girlfriend's name was Rose. And before we got up to caisson, on our way, we were in an area called Kowloon, where we had to guard bladders of fuel oil. And so we're one day below black guy and I are guarding, and he just jumped me, right? They had all these Marines, I think they had this, am I big and bad? Am I a badass? How do I know? Well, there's a little guy there that reads books. I'll jump him. So he just jumped me, you know, so I'd have taught, you know, tied him up in a knot, you know, and was choking him and everything. And then I said, okay, I give up, you know, and I let him go. Well, then he was my friend after that, right? Randy, before he knew that I'd get, not Randy, you know, Randy, he knew, he was there when I hauled our squad leader back. So he knew I could be counted on. And the other guys right around, he knew I could be counted on. Whether I read books or didn't, you know, sit around dissing each other's moms and girlfriends and blah, 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 doing that, what they do.
Yeah.
I didn't like it. I didn't, you know, I liked talking to the corpsmen. They were smart. One of them was a black corpsman. He was really smart, you know, I thought. So, wow, you went through all that school. How long was that school? You know, old as a year, you know, Navy corpsman. And, wow, I was impressed. So I was sort of a, and this was right in the media squad, I was kind of a loner. I found another bunker. What was it? We got moved over to the other side, not along the flat line, the back side of K-Zone. I found another bunker where I pretty much had it to myself and was reading a book. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. No, it was Hemingway, Bylines by Hemingway. And the Marine comes in. We had heard that he was getting out, sent home because he was a Jehovah's Witness. And he had this big Marine, big block letters, USMC on his shoulder. And he popped into the bunker one time and said, "Come on, Agan, who's fighting?" I go, "Fuck off." And then he batted the book out of my hand. So I knew what he was doing. He was baiting me. I wasn't going to play that game. I picked it up, kept reading it, batted it out of my hand, picked it up, kept reading it. "Come on, let's buy it." I went and said, "Tip off," you know. And but finally, he got to me, and I said, "Okay, sounds like a good idea." So we crawl out of the bunker, and I walk in front of him. I'm going to show him I am not afraid of you. I don't care how big you are, how bad you think you are. So we walk down to the flight line, not far, and I knew he was going to try to sucker punch. They teach us that. I'm walking in front of him, and we get underneath this bombed out C-130, this hole, and we're under the wing, you know, and sure enough, he tries to, you know, I'm walking from, I turn around, and there's a fist coming, and I duck that, and I knock him on his back, and I'm once again going for the throat, and I want to kill him. You know, he's going home with his big Marine tattoo and his stories about what a hero he is, and I'm only like a month or two in. So some of that rage was coming out, and some other guys pulled me off him. I don't know where they came from, whether they were his backup or what, or they just happened to be near this area. I don't know. But they pulled me off him. And the next morning I had to talk to, I think he was the commanding officer. And he says, "I don't know what your problem is, Akins, but you're going to CAP, and they always get overrun." I went, "Fine, I'm out of here." So I went to Combined Action Platoon, which is counterinsurgency.
Well, let me interrupt you there, Mr. Akins, just to kind of clear some
good
things
up. I'm going on and on.
No, that's perfectly fine. When you arrived in country, you go to Contien, but very shortly thereafter, you are going on foot to Quezon, is that correct?
On the way to Quezon.
On the way to Quezon. And how long did it take to get there?
I think it took about 90 days. I don't know. It seemed like I got there because we were in Quezon. We're just living underground with the rats, and they're big rats. you know, you can't spend much time above ground because they'll just start throwing in mortars or rockets. So I think I'd left Cape on first week in June when he said, you're going to Cap, and they always get overrun. I was choppered to Fubai, and it was June 8th, and there was a package from my dad that had some liquor sealed in a Purex bottle, just a foam, you know, melted foam. And I just turned 21, so I think it must have taken almost 90 days to get to Quezon, and then...
And what was the purpose of you going to Quezon, just to reinforce it? At this time,
right.
Of course, Quezon's being hit really hard.
Right. We were getting, before we got there, they were getting up to 30 rounds a day. And I could set my, if I had a watch, I could have set my watch by the incoming. I also learned I could identify what was being shot at us, whether it was a 82 mortar, 122 rocket, 152 artillery round. I could tell you what it was while it was in the air and whether it was going long or short or getting close. And I got blown up in a bunker on Garby CGL with another Marine, a Black Marine. I think I beat him when we crawled out of that thing, it was half caved in. I remember he looked gray from all the smoke, I mean the dust and everything. And the Jeep parked right next to it was on fire. And I said, we got to get to that command bunker. We were right outside the command bunker for Quezon. And I think I beat him there. We both popped out at about the same time, timed it, listened, and then I just, you know, it was like bang, and we were a foot race.
Yeah. Could you tell me what the living conditions were like there at Quezon, being bombarded so heavily during this time? What was it like to live there in this kind of environment? What were the surroundings looking like? You already talked about the trenches and the bunkers and things, but can you give me a description of Quezon while all this is coming in?
Well, it was blasted apart. It was garbage and broken bombed out bunkers, structures, like little wood fiber structures. You couldn't stay above ground very long, so you were living like a rat. When you did get outside, like if it was all socked in and you realized they couldn't see you, it felt really good to just be up and above ground. And it looked like a landfill that had been abandoned or something. It was busted up, ammo crates, pallets, whatever. It was pretty rough, pretty grim, you know, pretty like the top of a landfill or something. And it was just, I'd get garbage detail every day when it was our platoon's turn. And finally, the black guy was his girlfriend, Rose. I tried to tell him, Rose is not going to be there for you when you get back. You know, she's going to be with your brother, your cousin, some other guy. You know, just to give my heads up. That's Jody.
Jody, of course, right.
Yeah, well, he would tell the guy, why are you fucking with my man Akins all the time? You know, why do you give him garbage detail all the every day? I don't care, you know, whatever. I got my book, I'm just putting my time in and trying to stay safe. So, in 2000, I went back to Vietnam, and I went to Quezon. And when I got there, I just got the chills. I got the hair standing up on my arm because it was socked in, but you could still see the bottom of the mountain range. Quezon was in the Takong Valley. They were calling it Quezon because it was Quezonville, but the valley was called Takong, T D-A-C-O-N, two words. And some days it would be like socked in, and you could barely see the ridge line out in front of you, or to your west or east. And then the hills were real kind of close on the south. So, and other times you could, you'd watch the jets work out, and when the jets were working out, the phantoms, you could get up above ground and just watch them, because they were right out in front of you, just run after run, dropping 500-pound and 750-pound bombs. And then it was kind of like, yeah, man, go for it, you know, and you felt safe, and you could be up outdoors, and but it was, and there was, you know, for me, it was, if you went outside the wire, we weren't going outside the wire anymore, because it was right after they had 25 Marines that laid outside the wire that were ambushed. But there was a lot of controversy over this incident, whether this lieutenant took them beyond where they were supposed to go because he got gungy, or he was supposed to go there, and they walked into this big L-shaped ambush, and 25 Marines laid out there for a couple months before things quieted it down to where it was safe to go out there, because there was no way you could get into that spot without getting hit. It was too well protected. It was, and you just had to wait until you bombed them out of there, and then you could go in and recover.
Yeah. Well, that brings to mind a question. With all of this taking place, all of this activity, what was the morale like of the Marines there at Quezon?
Hmm. You have to give me a second on that. It was just putting our time in. I would rather, you know, I mean, while I was sitting there in Quezon, getting shelled, I wasn't up in 881 north or south, or 568 or 961. I wasn't up in those hills, and I kept reminding myself, well, I'm glad I wasn't here for the hill fight just before I got in country, because that was brutal. And I'm like, yeah, we're sitting here waiting for the big siege. So I think the morale, it was just like, it is what it is.
Yeah.
Like, this is what we're doing, and this is, you know, and this isn't so bad. It could be worse, I guess.
How are you guys being resupplied up there?
By truck up Highway 9 from Dong Ha, or sometimes by plane and by helicopter.
And how long would you be at Quezon before you moved out, or before you went to the CAP, the CAP platoon?
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Well, you know, I didn't keep track of time. I never had the calendar going or anything. I only know that I got to Compton in late January, early February. And I left Quezon first week in June. So I would say I must have been in Quezon 7 or 8 weeks or something.
Okay. Yeah.
How long could it? I don't know. It's hard for me to pin down.
Sure, sure.
Because I didn't care what day it was. I didn't care what time it was. It didn't matter. Time was not something to measure. Some people did, but when they got short, they really did. But I never did my whole tour, because by the time it was time for me to rotate, I was already home. I was home. I was so adapted to Vietnam, to protecting civilians and getting bad guys, and I was an adrenaline junkie that I didn't even know it was time to go home. I was home.
Yeah.
But by the time I was going home, I was also under a murder investigation for murder. That happened
Mr. Akins, let's stop there for today, because I think this is going to be another topic that we want to take on when we have a little bit more time, okay?
Sure.
This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Mr. John Akins. Today is 8 February 2016. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Akins is joining me by telephone from his home in Auburn, Washington. Mr. Akins, we left off last time, and we had just finished up your time there at Quezon. You described what was going on, kind of the pace of life, what the place looked like, what everyone was going through, the morale, etc. And you mentioned that you were going to be moved to a combined action platoon, a CAP platoon. Can you give me and give the listener of the interview an idea of what a CAP platoon was, its purpose?
Well, this was Marine counterinsurgency effort, where you had a squad of Marines working with Vietnamese military or Vietnamese militia or Vietnamese popular force troops. So we would try to combine the war fighting, like keeping the bad guys away from villages and hamlets, and at the same time provide some civic action, help with digging wells, help with building schools, and in my case, probably one of the major parts of the civic action was relocating a small hamlet of Fisher families out of a basically pre-fire zone, a zone that was pretty much infiltrated by North Vietnamese Army. I believe they were probably gearing up for the summer offensive, because we were getting a lot of action in the spring of 69.
Okay. Now, when did you make this move to the CAP platoon?
It was about the first week in June of 68.
Okay, 68 now.
That's when, you know, the word had come down to Fold Quezon, which was hard to stomach because so many Marines had been killed or maimed in that effort of getting to reinforce Quezon during and after of 68, and then all of a sudden they say it wasn't worth it, moving out, fold it up, blow it up. So that was kind of a blow to, and added to mine and others, that we were by then pretty certain that this was a wasted effort. This whole conflict was just a waste. So morale was kind of low, generally speaking. But there are always those that, you know, the true believers, the ones that are maybe not as well educated or as sophisticated, or they just go by the book and do their best.
And clearly, you were not one of those true believers by this time.
No, I was. I realized that it was just a total waste, a futile effort. And then after fighting working with Vietnamese, South Vietnamese fighting forces, realizing and understanding that they weren't committed, they wouldn't fight, they weren't going to put themselves in harm's way, they were going to take advantage of the U.S. largesse, you know, and survive. And so we understood that feeling. We were frustrated at first that they wouldn't fight, that they were dangerous to take into a fight or into an area where you were likely to get contact. So in the last team I was with, which three of us broke off and formed on our and operated on our own once we got a couple more Marines and a corpsman, we basically operated on our own for almost 6 months or more without supervision, and we left the locals behind when we went on patrol or set in an ambush or, you know, if we were doing civic action, we included them.
Mm-hmm.
They would help us. I hate that cliche, wins the heart and mind, but they would help us get across our message to the locals that we were trying to keep the NVA and some of the there were some Viet Cong. We were trying to keep them at bay where they wouldn't interfere with these people's lives. And at the same time, we would try to help them with supplies or equipment or I'm talking about like farming, or in the case of the fishing, there wasn't much we could do to help them with supplies, but medication, I mean, we did weekly med caps. We tried to do that weekly, or as often as we could, and as often as we could spare medical supplies, then we would hold what's called a med cap, where you go into a hamlet or a small enclave of local Vietnamese farmers, or in the latter, with my latter team, Fisher families, and treat the ill, the injured, as best we could.
Well, let's go back to the structure of these CAP platoons, and how would the Marines and the Vietnamese work together? And what sort of things? You talked about some of the projects you would work on, but are we talking about training? We're talking about military missions. Explain to me the interpersonal dynamic and how it worked with the small group of Marines, because we're talking about what? Four or five Marines, maybe more, maybe less, from time to time, living in these villages.
Yeah. So if you have five or six in a little compound, you were considered a squad. A squad of, what, 10 or 12 with a sergeant or something? But actually, it was maybe five or six at the most Marines, and probably all 18, 19, and 20. I turned 21 over there, so young and not full complement, but you would set up a little compound, so you would have some bunkers dug in, and you would have a barbed wire or perimeter fence, and maybe you'd have some concertina wire if you did, or maybe some apron wire out there in some of your perimeter and around each side if you were, you know, not backed up against a mountain or something. So you had a little perimeter with a few bunkers, and then you had the five or six Marines, and usually you would have five or so Vietnamese, and they would have bunkers as well. And some of them, they were coming and going. Some of them, you know, were staying in their local villages, and others were spending most of their time in the little compound. And so then you had an area of operation around the compound where you patrol, set up ambushes, and you just took the local fighters with you and showed them how to do it.
And
we weren't training them per se, other than helping them work on their English, and they'd help us work on our Vietnamese. There's your training. The other part of it was on the job, which is exactly how you learn to become an efficient, savvy war fighter. It's on the job. It isn't back in Camp Lejeune or NCRD San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the job.
And who were these people that you were working with, these men that you would be working with in the platoon?
the locals were anywhere from almost teenage, most of them were a little older, into their 40s, and they were equipped with nylon rucksacks. We still had canvas. They had the newest, latest M16. So they had the same equipment basically we did, and were just like one of us, but they were Vietnamese and we were American. So we had a complement of a core of 10 or 12 or less Vietnamese stationed at your compound, and when there was Tet, they were gone. That's their only holiday, and they go to the family. But during regular part of the year, they're pretty much assigned to your compound and live there with you.
Now, were you, or I should ask you this, how was it decided that a village would need a CAP platoon with them? Are the village leaders going to the Marine Corps and saying, hey, we would like to have you guys here to help protect us? Is the Corps saying, hey, you know, or is it provincial advisors who are doing this? How does that work?
Well, initially, I mean, in the first two teams I was with, probably the regular United States bureaucracy, working with local village chiefs and Arvin bureaucracy to have, I guess, maybe these agreements. Now, on our, so that was already in place when you got pulled out of infantry and sent to the CAP counterinsurgency program.
Mm-hmm.
You got a week of orientation, a few days of orientation, and then were sent to a team, and so they were in place. Now, my last team, we actually were the bureaucrats, I guess. We approached this one hamlet that was not far from the team that we were assigned to, which was CAP 117, and when the three of us decided to break off, we just didn't go back after a day-long patrol. But the next day, we went down to the nearest hamlet that we had come through before we swung north, and found this place. It looked like a good place for a CAP. We went back to that nearest hamlet and talked to the village chief and said, and showed him on the map, we're going to set up here and we will try to work with your local militia or your popular force troops or whoever you can, that you have. We will work with them, and the village chief sent a day or two later, up came a crew carrying, and we had got rolls of barbed wire and stakes and loads of empty sandbags and stuff like that. And this crew came up and helped us build the compound. We just worked together side by side with them. That was great. Working with these guys that ranged from 20 to 60, just getting to know them and eating with them, stopping for a smoke break with them and saying, no, you don't have to pull the filter apart like it's a punk to light it. You just light the other end. They like menthol filtered cigarettes. They got Salem, stuff like that. And so we just worked together side by side, got to know each Within a few days, we had a nice little compound. We had one strand of barbed wire on stake around it, three strands. And then I think later we might have put in a little, that low crisscross apron wire out in front of the three wire fence around our little compound. And we had about one, two, three, maybe six bunkers, three for us, three for them. And it was a small little compound, so it didn't have a big, like what you look at as a sunken, covered picnic area. But the first camp I was with had that, and that was kind of where they would, the locals, popular force or the Neoquan or the Vietbop militia types would string their hammocks and hang out and during the day, in the night here in the bunker or on watch or on patrol or in an ambush. But on that last team, 116, we didn't have that much room. We had a little high ground and a small compound. And we had the river on one side, the jungle front and back, and the ocean on the east side.
So you're chosen for this, mission. You didn't have any facility in the Vietnamese language at the time. I assume that you went to a language course, probably in Da Nang. Is that correct?
I did. Which turned out to be fortunate because I was on the truck at the Chu Lai, near the Chu Lai airstrip, waiting for a driver to take three of us from CAP 111 to the chopper pad to go to the new CAP 114. So we're sitting on the truck, in the back of the truck, waiting for a driver to take us to the chopper pad. And there's a local Marine there, this is in the rear area, who had a pet monkey that was entertaining us, would sit on your shoulder and peek through your hair, find a little thing to eat. It felt really good, a little massage. And then all of a sudden, another Marine clerk came out and said, "Hey, can you get off the truck? You've got orders for language school in Da Nang." And it was a 30-day intensive, 10 hours a day, 6.5 days a week school. And if you failed one daily quiz, you were booted out and sent back to the group. Well, I had been trying to learn Vietnamese once I got around them, and once I got into the CAP program, because I figured there was one thing positive I could get out of this experience, was to learn a foreign language. And as many have mentioned, I found out when I was leaving Travis Air Force Base, or the other one right there in the Bay Area, California, that I had orders for Department of Defense 3 months to 1 year language school in Monterey. But that didn't happen. Instead, I was just on my way. This was during TAP. I said it erupted, and two or three weeks later, they needed infantry worse than they needed transport.
Sure.
And I worked on getting better at Vietnamese all the while that I was in the CAP program.
The first platoon that you belong to, as I recall, is 111. Where was this one located? What village were you in or near?
This is a funny thing about a tour in the Marine Corps. You're moving around, you don't know where you are, but we were in Quang Nai province, which is now part of Quang Nai. So Quang Nai and Quang Nam were separate little provinces not far from Highway 1, maybe west of Highway 1, and south of Da Nang, about 70 or 80 clicks was the headquarters for all the security caps that were designated by 1-1 whatever. So it was first combined action group. It's headquartered in Chulai, which was maybe 30, I don't think it was, maybe 30 minutes, 45 minutes south of Tam Ki, which is where the Army MACV compound was. But and they had a little airstrip for spotter pilots and stuff. So, Quang Nai Province, now called Quang Nam, and between Chulai and near Chulai, which south of Da Nang, south of Hoi An, which was a port city back in the 1700s, probably the most busy port city, one of the most busy in the world, was Hoi An, until the river silted in. That was maybe 40 clicks north of us. And Hoi An is about an hour south by motorbike of Da Nang. And then we moved, I moved, 114 got overrun. Everybody was killed and wounded while I was at night school. So 114 was on distance, and then, so the next gap was 117, which was due east of Tam Ki, which was a little frontier boom town on Highway 1 between Hoi An and Chulai. So Tam Ki was in also in Quang Nai Province, which is now Quang Nam Province.
Okay. Now you talked about the civic action types of things, as well as the medcaps that you would be involved with from time to time. What about the military mission? Can you tell me how you tried to achieve the military mission of the CAP?
Yeah, it was real simple. We were going to get rid of NVA and Viet Cong. So we were, it was like Friday night lights every day or every afternoon or, you know, I mean, there was a lot of NVA and Viet Cong right north of our pause when we were 116 on that isthma where the river, it just splits into all these deltas and waterways, you know, this whole area just got, if you look at a map, there's just fingers of inlets and little islands and sandbars and stuff. So, what we found west of 117 and north of Pifuville was our jumping off spot when we crossed the river from 117 and went west toward the ocean across this river that had split into many little deltas and riverlets and stuff. We were now in a hot area. We were the only position in that area, and so we could get in a firefight just about any time we left the fire, the wire, day or night. For several months it was like that. Now there were times when it was slow. There were times when we were recouping, I guess. And but then when, I mean, I remember sitting around, it had been a few days that we had had contact, and I said to everybody, hey, you know, it's been a few days since we've had contact. It's time to get some. Let's go out tonight. Let's leave early in the morning and go north. And we would most likely get into an ambush or a firefight.
Now, were these things that you would set up ambushes on on particular trails like typical? Or are you walking around looking for things? Are you trying to gather intelligence? Are you just waiting for the ambush? What are you doing there with them?
It was all kind of the planning part was when we decided our mission for a while was going to be relocate this little hamlet of that hot area up north of us. Okay, so that took a lot of planning and stuff. We made incursions into the area. We found a local. We told them as quick as we could through the Marines, you know who we are. You probably heard us in the night or whatever if we get getting ambushed or something. We're down at this position. There's a hamlet south of us with vacated homes and bunkers and everything. And we're offering you the opportunity to move south of us, to move to the safe area south of our position. And then we'd have to get out of there because in no time we'd be getting fired. So typically it was put on this combat shirt that I had designed and had sewn up for me as well. And pick up my 16, that was already in my pocket, and we're ready to go. And if we went out in the daytime, we were, anytime we went out, we were looking for a fight because we had adapted to this job, which was pretty exciting. And especially when you're getting surrounded and you got to run for it, or if you're up invited to fly with a spotter pilot and you happen to be back in Tampa on Highway 1 and some Air Force guy comes up to you and he's out in that MACV compound and says, hey, are you those guys that are way out there between the river and the ocean? And they go, yeah, that's us. About my map, show them that. Here's our position. He goes, yeah. I know you guys are getting a lot of contact up there. Would you like to fly with me? And so the next morning I went up with him. Well, that was pretty exciting. We got the best bomb damage assessment of the day for all of I Corps. So that was not really typical. That just got the, it all went into the headquarters record book, but it didn't make the E6s and E7s and E5s happy at all that we were doing stuff like this. This is what officers do, not a bunch of Lance Corporals or PSCs.
Well, let me ask you about that. You say that you guys just came back from, I guess you were 117, and decided you just weren't going to go back because you liked this other area better.
We didn't go back that one afternoon. We just stayed. Three of us stayed.
So three of you stayed, and you just said, we're going to set one up here. Who did you tell, hey, we're setting one up here. We need some supplies. We need some wire. We need some additional guys. How did that work?
Well, we just told the other Marine who had been at 117 longer than the two of us, and maybe the third guy hadn't been there all that long. And we had already figured out that that 117 was lame. They were just sitting in, buying their time, and we did nearly get overrun one afternoon. And I had been assigned to City Cal, and so I got down to mow down the jungle. You can harvest trees with a City Cal. And my other guy, the other new guy, that became my main partner, Bruce Barr, he was on the M16, and basically we were about the only two that were returning fire. And so when we saw how this new team to us, we weren't at 117 all that long, but when we saw how they were operating, and we went on that patrol one day, leaving behind basically the squad leader and the assist at 117. And so half of us of 117, or a few of us with a bunch of local militia went up north and found this high ground and looked around, and I just made the comment that this would be a good place for a position. And my buddy Bart, the other new guy, goes, yeah, so why don't we stay? And then the third guy goes, hey, yeah, I'll stay with you. And so we told the ones that were going back when it was time to go back, we're not going back. And they're going, you're fucking crazy. You have a radio with the locals, give us your radio and whatever grenades you have and anything extra you got, and we'll be fine. And so they gave us a radio, because the locals had a couple radios, and they went on back to 117, and we stayed. And then what we would do was we would radio in SIDRUP situation report to headquarters in Chulai. And when we were checking in, we had stuff to tell them. It was this many kills, this many we captured 12 NVA. We found some maps on NVA, who we're dealing with. We're dealing with NVA. We did get two Viet Cong. They were doing this. We got one AK-47. So we would just give them a situation report. The only time we would contact the rear is when we fill them in what we'd accomplished and when we needed supplies. And so it was all done by radio. And later on, they got tired of us being out there on our own and just doing this and doing that and having Army people contact us and setting up a little operation for them. Oh, you're going to go up the river on this side of the river, and you're looking up there. Well, here's where we are, and here's where we operate across the river from where you're going. So we'll form a blocking force if you're going to cross the river, or if you're going up near the river, and if you flush something, we'll be here. Here's our call sign. And then we would move up. I ended up in some tent near MACB, showing on a big wall map, showing these guys where we were, where we get contact. Oh, you're going up here? Okay, well, you might get some contact because you're opposite where we're getting contact all the time. And then we would plan a little joint operation with the Army. We had the Swift boats where we would take them, we would patrol with the Swift boats. A couple of us would go up the coast with a Swift boat. One day they wanted to. Some of their crew wanted to go on land and see what is it that we're doing. And we took a few of them, got sniped at, and went back, and they're fucking crazy, you guys. You're out here by yourself, and I don't know where the animosity came from between our headquarters, mid-level staff, and us. They were just reading our report or monitoring our radio call, or of course we would be calling in fire missions, we would be calling in jets. I had the call sign for the Missouri, which the Swift boat captain gave me, which I never was going to call in because if they were a little off, they'd wipe us out. That's a huge artillery piece. And maybe the Air Force guy let our headquarters know about that test bomb thing. I don't recall calling that one in. The Air Force guy, the SWAT pilot, called me the next day on the radio, told us how we did. We saw the secondary explosions, and it was pretty exciting. his nervous breakdown. So that's exciting. He
yeah.
really taught me how to fly the plane on the way back. On the way to and from, he let me fly. He gave me a flying lesson.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, he gave me his jumpsuit, too. He told me to take the wings off because if he gets captured, he'll be on the way to Hanoi.
Right, right.
We were all in infantry up north around Cape Town, and then we just adapted to the, we'd already adapted to the violence. We'd already figured out this is a lost cause. We'd already figured out that fucked up supervision is dangerous, and so we just melded into a really efficient team where nobody was in charge. They sent somebody out to be in charge. It was a guy from 111. I've been friends with him, but he didn't fit. He had gone career. He had gone lifer. He started telling us what to do and knock off that hey man stuff, and he was messing up our program. So I asked the village chief to have him removed.
And the chief could do that then.
The chief, yes. The Vietnamese have more power than anybody, I guess. I mean,
yeah, it's their village, it's their people, so it would stand to reason. You're there to assist, of course.
Yeah. So I figured out how to solve problems. So basically, the four or five of us that were together for a while, we're getting our PhD in guerrilla warfare and in dealing with the system, or actually avoiding the system, avoiding the chain of command, avoiding the stateside military thing that often was present in rear areas in the Vietnam combat zone. So for every one warfighter that is actually in the ship, there's 7 to 9 in a nice rear area where they're coddled, except for the back 7 and the lording over of rank and stuff like threat of being sent to the court. They were probably having a nice time. Two or three. The further and the bigger the rear, the further from the fight and the bigger the base, the more like drug meth it was, in my estimation. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll back there.
Yeah.
Well, for us, it was contact. That's pretty exciting. Escaping death, having jets work out over you, having Cobra gunships fire for you, having Healy gunships helping bail you out, and artillery from miles away saving your base.
Now, you have written about this somewhat extensively in I guess what we could probably call your memoir.
Right.
Namagogo, I believe is the title of it. Now,
Namagogo, Falling to the Vietnamese Cause of War.
There you go. Thank you for that. Can you talk to me about the process by which, at least according to you in the memoir that you've written, you kind of transform, I guess is a way to say it, from being a line soldier to someone who's working counterinsurgency, who's working in the CAP platoon, who's living, eating, breathing with the Vietnamese you're working with. It seems to me, and I hope that you'll be able to speak to this, that a different kind of sense of mission of or purpose of why you're there and operating out on your own as it develops. It seemed like it fit you and fit the others with you. Can you talk about that a little bit? Kind of explain what I'm trying to get at here.
Radio reports and requests for research. we saw a football at my hospital in Oklahoma. And we did, they would take one or two of us in to their fort for the night, you know, where we could eat amazing food and sleep on a mattress with them. And, you know, and see yourself in the mirror and go, whoa, what? So, I don't know if I answered your question. I might have gone on a tangent, but the process is incremental, and then you end up with three or four guys, because people would hear about 116, and they were gungy, oh, we want to get out there. And they'd come out, and so we just take them on a trial by fire, a little walk up the beach, and see how they reacted, and boy, sometimes they didn't, just a few sniper rounds were enough to get them to get themselves out. Some of them that got into a firefight, that was it for them. They got themselves out of 116. Our first corpsman got himself out of 116 after a daytime patrol. But this is too dangerous. Well, we adapted, we really strongly believed that we had to protect the innocent. And we went to some risk to talk a hamlet that was in a pre-fire zone that was infiltrated with NDA and Viet Cong, maybe being used as slave labor, maybe whatever. I imagine they took their women for entertainment and, you know, and doing their bidding, and we were up there fighting, and rounds were flying, and they're in the middle of it. I mean, if you are wealthy in a place that there's been a lot of contact, and you hear a cough, you light it up, you fire away. And then you have to get out of there so you just announce your presence.
Yeah.
You don't know if that call was a civilian or an NDA or a Viet Cong. But it's all action and reaction. You get a sixth sense. I can almost predict if we were gonna get hit. And it's been one night I called it right on the, I hit the nail on the head. I stopped the patrol. We were going, just as Marines going up the beach, and I'd already seen this area in the daytime, and I came up where I saw where the tree line curved out, and I said, hey, I think this might be okay. So everybody pull back 30 meters, link up all the gun ammo, and I'm going to stay ahead. Small target, not 5'6". So the others were 30 meters back and ready for action. And as soon as I got in near that part of the land of the beach that curved out, where the tree line curved out, they lit it up and we were in a fight. And I think that's part of the adaption is your gut. It's from experience. From experience, your brain rewires, and your gut, I think there's some circuitry down in there, your gut that goes right to that prefrontal cortex that says, there it is, it's coming, get ready. So, I think what was unusual, it may not be so unusual to break off and operate on your own. What I think is unusual is that adaptation, and yet keep that enough. Your emotional radar is sweeping a blank screen. When your friend gets killed, you don't think about it longer than 5 seconds. It's better him than you. When they
Did you stay here at 116 until the end of your tour, the 13 months?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I was quite surprised when they sent a chopper out telling me it was time to rotate.
Tell me about that.
Well, I was just like, just forgot about home. I wasn't home. We had a mission. We had the ocean for our recreation. If somebody come up to the rear area and could get them a little opium-treated joint, simply, and then they look a billion stars out at night, then we could have our six-pack or our comparable highball or two with an opium-treated joint and a wire, a nearly dead 25 radio battery to a little, somebody's little tiny pocket-sized transistor radio, and get on board the radio and hear from Martha and the Vandellas and show each other our moves, you know, our dancing, just having a good time, and then breaking into a tape and see Rasmus, and we can all shit this, the chocolate little thing that came with the crackers and the pieces and pound cake, and so that was our break, that and swimming in the South China Sea.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember telling my main partner, Barr, one day on the beach, relaxing, that I'm not cold-blooded, but I'm into this shit.
Mm-hmm.
And he pointed out, yeah, we're just living on the excitement of the challenge. Maybe the thing that kept us a little bit sane, because insanity is an asset in combat. Some insanity too. But the sanity part, I think, was trying to protect the civilians. That's what I'm most proud of, is that we moved 40 or 60 people, three generations of them, down the beach, relocate out of that hot area. Because anytime we were up there, we weren't the only ones in danger. The civilians were in danger, and so we were a little bit calm and together.
Eventually, this, like you said, you're kind of grooving on the excitement here, but it's time for the excitement to end. What were your thoughts about leaving?
Oh, my. At all celebrating leaving Vietnam when I finally got on an airplane in Da Nang, I was very worried because I knew that I had 5 months and 20 days left. My CEO on the exit interview said, trying to get me to re-up, and I said, well, am I going to re-up if I get jump school? And he said, no, jump school's 3 months. You have 5 months and 20 days left, you won't get that. And I said, no, then I won't re-up. And then on the plane, I just could not feel any sense of relief or celebration, because I knew that 5 months and 20 days that I would be training troops to go over there, and that I could not do that, that I would be sending them to Mexico and Canada, because it wasn't worth it. You know, and so I was kind of in a hump emotionally, psychologically, because of that. I just could not, I was very worried about that I would end up on a multi-year strip of break and making up bad time.
Yeah.
Back in the break, making up bad time. Because I was not training troops today.
you wind up? How did you wind up with the early out?
Well, some of them. Anybody that has been in combat for a year or so was eligible for release from active duty, relapse. I did not know this. I did not know how the Marine Corps worked. I went to boot camp, to war fighting, and then back. So, but on the bus from El Toro to Treasure Island Naval Base, I sat next to a Chinese American who had been a payroll clerk on Guam. And he could tell right away that I was edgy. He saw the MPs following me as soon as we got into Treasure Island Naval Base. And he took me under his wing and said, look, we have to make these formations. First of all, I walked and asked some clerk when we checked in, what formations do we have to be at? We have to be involved. Well, he got it all. He got the whole layout for that week. And it turns out his brother was getting his PhD at Berkeley. So he took me under his wing. He did two things. He said, one, you're eligible for early out. So you, when we go through processing, I'm going to go with you. I'm going to make sure your papers go in the right pile. And then he also said, my brother lives with some other students on our house in Berkeley. And so the first time we get leave, we're going there, and we can get leave. Only officers get leave. So you come with me into the PX. I'm going to buy some Captain's Bar. You just stand over there and don't say anything. Well, here's a guy that had MPs following him everywhere. I went. You know, it wasn't hard to follow. I say that. And I dug and leave and do this and do that. And sure enough, there were two MPs following me everywhere I went those first 2 days on Treasure Island. So anyway, he goes into the PX, he goes over to the ECOS stuff where the insignia is, and he gets a dual packet of Captain Spar and a couple other things. And I walked up to the checkout stand, the clerk, and he puts them on the table, and I'm standing right there. And he just rang them up and gave them to him, and then we got out of the PX. He pinned them on his jacket, and we walked out of Treasure Island, got the salute, and went to Berkeley, where I told him, hey, well, I'm going to hit on some of these kids. He said, yeah, right. Well, I did it. I tried, and it was like, oh. Just say, hey, how are you doing? What's your major? Isn't going to cut it. So what am I going to say? Well, I couldn't think of anything to say. But I sure didn't want anybody to know where I've been and what I've been doing. And even to this day, I'm not comfortable with people knowing what I'm doing and what I'm thinking. I'm still kind of, like, prefer the shadows. Metaphorically, I guess.
Yeah. Were you, you get this early out. When do you officially separate from the Marine Corps?
The official, the release was in late April, early May, 69, but the official, the six-year commitment was up July 7, 1974, I think.
Mm-hmm. Because of the inactive status or whatever it would have been.
Yeah, I was on inactive status, but not ready reserve.
Yeah.
So,
once you finish your time with the Marine Corps on active duty, obviously, what's next for you? What did you want to do? Do you have a career in mind, education in mind? Did you want to go back to school? What was next for you?
I just couldn't figure it out at all. I knew I had to get out of my parents' home, but I just was, it was so bizarre to go from the bush to actually being on University Ave at the University of Washington, where they had bombed out the administration building, where I would have gone to sign up to readmit to the University of Washington to take up where I left off.
Mm-hmm.
It was just too weird. So what, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what I should do. I even asked my dad, what should I do? I never had real close kind of relationship with my father, but he was a Scotch-Irish, you know, and engineer. I didn't know what, I was so weird. I sat down in front of the register, my little heat register, in my parents' living room, opposite the front door, like I'd done growing up. All four kids, and later five, would race to one of two registers in the morning to get some heat in the house. And I sat there and I realized that if I had to survive another day, I could line up my whole family and kill them. And I just thought, I have to start over. Well, I didn't know how to start over. I didn't know where to go. Should I go to Colorado? Should I go to Greeley, Colorado, and go to school there? Because I had one time looked at a map somehow, thought maybe if I make it home out of Vietnam, I'll go to Greeley, Colorado, little college town. I didn't know what to do. Well, I sent a telegram to Bruce Barr in Brooklyn and said, I'm on this flight. And when I got off the flight, he was there. So I spent a couple weeks there, and we went to the United Nations building, and I went to Gettysburg by myself. He got a job, and the plan was we were going to buy motorcycles and go up to Canada and head west back to Seattle, because he had spent time in Seattle before he got inducted. So anyway, turns out we would have had to wait 6 months to get licenses on motorcycles. So I remember going one day to Gettysburg and sitting amongst them and just feeling like I could commune with them. I felt like, okay, I know what you went through. You went through a civil war, and I know what you went through, but yours was honorable and mine was not. And so I felt, you know, guilt and shame, even guilt at surviving. You know, I thought it would have been better if I had been killed over there. It would have just been better. This is how I felt. So I couldn't. I was trying to find my way. I came back. I flew back to Seattle. I visited a gal who I'd met before I went into boot camp in Philadelphia. She was still living at home. I was too anxious. I wasn't going to wait around for her to move out and get together. And so I flew back home and said, I'd go to work. I worked, you know, I've worked since I was 12, 13. And my first job was at 16. And so I knew I could work construction, so I started working construction, and I thought about, I didn't know what to do, so I was answering an ad in I had seen in and clipped out and kept in my wallet. I'd seen an ad in the Sydney Times or Sydney Australia Journal or something, and it was from that Colonel Michael Hare, known as Mad Mike, who was a RAF Royal Air Force former soldier that had never been in combat, but he was running around in Rhodesia and as a mercenary, and apparently he was a good con artist or something. But anyway, he'd gotten contacted by the U.S. government to get a mercenary force to go fight for the Lon Nol government in Cambodia. So I was going to sign up for that.
Well, yeah, kind of get back to where you were, in a sense.
And what I was good at, mm-hmm. what I knew. I said, well, at least I'll make some money at it. then I thought, and I contacted him, and he said, okay, fly to Miami and meet so-and-so. And then we'll go from there, blah, blah, blah. And then I thought, who am I going to be with? Guys that have been reading the backs of Soldier of Fortune magazine, guys that are rejects from the military, guys that are yahoos that don't know anything. I'm not going to have my team. And if I'm not going to have my team, I'm not going to do this. So that's a good thing, or I probably wouldn't be standing here talking to you. But and so instead, I started working in construction again, and then I did go back to the University of Washington for the sole purpose to stick it to Uncle Sam. I was going to get the GI Bill. So I did that. Well, I went and signed up at some temporary place since the administration building had been bombed out. I wasn't real sure about being back and, people running around blowing things up. But I signed up. I had to pick a history. I remember my 8th grade history teacher. I said, history said, you can't get the GI Bill unless you pick a major. So I picked history, and I'm back at the UW, University of Washington, Seattle. And just so I could get the GI Bill, and maybe I'll figure it out, and there'll be co-ed, and maybe it'll give me time to figure out what to do. And so I'm back on campus, and the GI Bill was $130 a month, period. That was supposed to cover your cost, your educational cost to attend a four-year university. So that means your room, your board, your books, your fees, your registration, tuition, everything. And I thought, oh, that's not going to cut it. So I would go to school 2 quarters, then work construction 2 quarters in order to have enough saved up to go to school and not have to work, because I wanted to play rugby, not work. So I managed to squeeze 4-year degree into 8 years, I guess, counting my first year and a half before I lost my student deferment.
And you wind up with your degree. What's the next step for you?
Well, I have a teaching certificate. And this was 1974, and that's when they had that oil embargo in 73. And so that's when they had the sign, the big billboard on I-5, the main freeway between home and Seattle. Last one to leave Seattle, please turn out the lights. Some Boeing engineer or some Boeing graphic artist or something came up with that. So we were in a recession, our first recession. They were laying off teachers. So I couldn't get a job teaching. I did my student teaching. And I just began a long to-do list of jobs and careers that ended in 2000. Or 99. So I think I worked construction. I did odd stuff, bartending. Then I worked as a flood irrigator in the Little Belt Mountains in Montana on a big cattle grazing operation. And then I worked on green chains at mills in Montana. I wanted to get established in Montana. It's where I was born. I liked Montana. They had the rugby team. They had the old boy rugby team I could plug in. I just liked it there, but I never could really get established. It was all part-time or killer work jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got into Seattle Fire Department. I think I was 18th out of 2,500 on their pre-test and the mental, physical test and everything, but I had reservations about going into a quasi-military thing, and it wasn't a good fit because I mean, I'd be in there fighting the fire while other, as you get after recruit school, while they're still gearing up. And I'd get in trouble because I'd be already in there putting out the fire while they're gearing up. And it's a club. I didn't fit in. They're going, why are you always running up and down the stairs and working out and stuff? Well, because I want to be in shape for rugby, you know, and I want to be pound for pound the most strongest guy on the field, you know. And boy, I had the aggression, so I made up for only being 136 pounds of twisted steel and sex appeal.
Right.
With aggression. And it smoothed me out. It's a lifesaver, really. So between playing rugby, working construction, going off working flood irrigation, well, I finally got smoothed out. I got into a 4-year apprentice, and I remember signing a big sigh of relief. I was living out in the hills in an old cabin that was part of our old homesteaded Italian goat ranch. And it was kind of remote and commuting to construction stuff. And, but this apprenticeship, I went, big sigh of relief because I went, I got this nice place to live. I got the dog. I got a girlfriend. I got my health. And I know where I'm going to be for the next 4 years. And that was a big relief.
Yeah, I bet.
Big relief. And so for those 4 years, and then when I topped out, I hit the road and worked as a tramp wireman welder for about 12 years. And, you know, I liked night shift. There was no supervision. I liked the shadows. I liked the big jobs, 200 guys on a site and night shift. And welding, you're kind of on your own, and or wiring, whatever, on the big jobs. I liked that. But then my son was born, and I thought, oh, I got to become a steady Eddie. I was 40, and so I tried to go white collar. I came down out of Alaska. I was working on the slope on the Arctic Circle on the oil pipeline, again, wiring and welding. And went to a local small town newspaper where my wife or girlfriend was working. Court reporter, and I asked them to be an intern, and they said, well, we're no longer affiliated with union. And I was a union guy since I was 16, but I said, well, I don't care. And he goes, well, what experience do you have? And I showed him some writing samples. I started telling my story to practice up to try to become a journalist. And I later threw all that away, which was a mistake, because I had all the names and places and even probably grid coordinates and stuff. But I got on. I said, I'll work for free. And so I worked 6 months for free as like a junior reporter. At first, they didn't really give me anything to do. We write press releases or something. And, but I kept picking people's brains, and a business reporter from Sweden, you know, he said, oh, you got to learn how to, don't use the typewriter, learn how to use the computer. And he sort of gave me a few nudges in the right direction. And then in 6 months, I won a couple of journalism awards, and I was still trying to learn more. I learned the dark room, where I wrecked the whole can of that guy that gave me the help of his film. And he had to reshoot everything for the big local community fair. So I sat there. But then I kind of got smoked from there. And I just kept trying different stuff. I wanted to become liaison between the print shop and the editorial, because they were always squabbling over space and what they could, how, you know. So I thought, well, maybe I can learn what print shop does so I can help editorial so that we can work smoother together. But that didn't go anywhere, and I couldn't get a raise because I hadn't been to the managing editor said, well, you haven't been to J school. I went, what's J school? He goes, journalism. I went, oh, well. And then I came to work one morning, and one of those gals that's kind of the heart and soul of the operation, knows everything that's going on, works, does multitasks on a small daily newspaper and knows what the boss wants to do. Hey, I think they're done. She said, you better be careful. You're going to get called in to see the manager. And so I got called in there and decided to resign, so I resigned there on the spot and moved on and kept moving on and moving on until about 2000. I had my last job was high school teacher.
Okay. And when did you retire?
2001, 2000. Yeah.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Akins.
I was in the VA system in 99, and they basically told me you're retired. After 2 weeks on the psych ward and talking my way out of any further mental health rigmarole. I mean, they wanted me to do another 2 weeks on the PTSD ward, but I said, this place is making me crazier. And so they did release me after the 2 week stay on the psych ward.
So they brought you in for evaluation, and that kind of rolls into to what I want to ask you.
It opened the door for me to treatment.
Was, or do you believe that the way your Vietnam experiences affected you had something to do with the numerous jobs moving from place to place, not really feeling comfortable in all of these places? Do you think that had something to do with it?
Oh, absolutely. I didn't realize it, but I was still operating like I operated in the CAF. Get out of my way, you know. You give me an assignment, well, then get out of the way. And, you know, I would step on toes, and I would go around people that wanted to muddle up on a project, you know, just to get their name involved with it and stuff like that, and I didn't need that. So yeah, it did. I mean, I would become the go-to guy, and then I would get fired or I would quit. And it, because I couldn't compromise my scruples, and I couldn't handle in white collar especially the backstabbing. It was amazing. People would try to trick you into delaying your project so they could get theirs out ahead of yours. And then when you'd say stuff like, well, let me run it by the boss. And then they'd come back a minute later, oh, never mind, never mind. You know. But I just, I couldn't play office politics is basically it. I couldn't do that. And it was strange to me. I write in the latter book, Drowning Out the Drum, A Marine Comes Home. I write about what a waste it is of these young guys that came home from Vietnam who had immense responsibility and even accountability and decision-making and had to plan the thing. It was the 18 and 19 and 20 year olds that were running the war. And the officers who were smart recognized that these guys with 5 months experience were a valuable resource, and to let them plan the thing and run it by them, and if they say that isn't going to work, then adjust. You know, those officers made good officers and probably survived better. But when you bring that type of modus operandi back to the white-collar world in the U.S. of A., you're going to get smoke.
Yeah.
Or yeah. And so my longest white collar job lasted 3 years, and I celebrated. I took my girlfriend and her friend, her roommate girlfriend, out to dinner in downtown Tacoma, Washington, on the 60th floor of the whatever building it was, Bank of America or something. You know, we had a little earthquake while we were up there. Kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it did cost me. But, you know, if you got with the right company, a small startup or something, you would have been an asset. But I almost did. I had a job lined up kind of with Starbucks when they owned, and when I called Howard Schultz after watching him testify in a B&O meeting, in a Ways and Means Committee meeting for the Washington State Legislature about our regressive B&O tax, and he talked about Starbucks. I knew Starbucks. I'd gone there many times, the original, up on Pike Place Market along the waterfront of Seattle downtown. There's a cutlery store next door, and in between was my rugby friend's little fish bar. So I was always up there replacing pocket knives, and I'd go to Starbucks, the two Italian brothers. So when I heard this former New York bond trader talking about it, I went right to my computer and got my flip file up and my cover letter, put a new date on it, wrote some new material, sent in my clip file to them, and then I thought, well, hey, this guy was a stockbroker. He's probably on the job at 6:45 like me. So I called him up, and he answered the phone. And I said, oh, I'm just following up on that clip file I sent you about working for Starbucks, because I think you're on the right trail, and blah, blah, blah. And he said, oh, yeah, I got your stuff, you know, but we only got 6 employees right now. Call me in 6 months. Well, 2 of his employees had worked in for the governor, and I had worked for one temporarily, one of my temporary jobs, L&I, was Joe Deere. The governor's chief financial officer went to work for Starbucks, and he lived in the same little town that I had been at and lived out. So I think I had it wired, but I didn't follow through. I never played golf.
Yeah, there you go.
Who are you going to tackle? Who's going to chase you?
Right. You know, it's interesting that you have gone through this varied career over the years, and like you say, you think it's clearly related to your experiences there in Vietnam, and mm-hmm. having to deal with the VA as well, as you mentioned.
Yeah, it's tough.
You know, when you look back on all of these experiences in the Marine Corps as a member of CAP Platoon, being out there, you know, on the knife's edge, doing all of these things, coming back to the States, and the difficulties, obviously, that kind of related to or came from this, when you look back on it, how do you think your Vietnam experiences have most influenced you, your life?
Well, I'm not afraid of dying. I think there's a military way and a civilian way. If you have experience in both, it might come in handy someday.
Mm-hmm.
Or it might be a good thing in the work world, but you have to adjust. Like, I adjusted to war fighting, but I really didn't adjust so much to working in an office and with hierarchy and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Bosses that really are, what's the Peter Principle, right? You run into that.
Yeah, of course.
Well, I didn't have to, you run into that in the military, but not out in the bush.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, out in the bush, you're just on your own, and that's the best. But did I want to start my own business? No, I did not. I didn't have the courage for that, because you not only had to have something marketable, you had to be a rainmaker. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to play sports after work. I wanted to train for sports after work. I wanted to keep playing. I played rugby, I was 45 or more, yeah. Playing old boys, and I wanted to, I was training for rodeo, and I had to stop that when I got a kid and had to be a steady Eddie, and I wanted to train for triathlon. And I did the Ironman, and the first year that I started triathlon, and I did well. I did not want to make. I was not gonna. Well, let me tell you, if I would have spent as much time and effort on climbing the ladder as I did on training for competition, I'd probably be pretty well off.
Hmm.
But bored, I would be a boring person. I've had a much more interesting life.
Hmm. Yeah.
This way. But it cost me, I guess, because I couldn't find my niche. Almost, I did find my niche, but then my boss died, and the new boss, and I, I saw him, a candidate. He was a candidate for the job, and he was from Washington, D.C., and we were at a national convention in Seattle. So I'm walking across 4th Avenue, right in the heart of downtown Seattle, four lanes, big crosswalk, and a colleague I'm with, and we're walking across, see that guy standing over there coming our way? He's the other guy they're considering for Wayne's job, my boss that died of pancreatic cancer. And by the time I got across the street, I said to my friend, colleague, I said, what a dickhead. All right. He wanted to micromanage in a small office with only 8 people, and 2 of those people were field hands. I mean, they were out in various parts of the state, covering all the parts of the state. So there was really 6 of us in the office. And I had this boss. He was a gem. He was great. You know, he called me in one day, and I went, oh, shit, I must have screwed up. I'm going to get smoked here or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, no, he just wanted to vent a little bit because the governor was thinking about subsuming our little agency, state agency, into the gigantic Department of Ecology, which is just a big bureaucracy. But we were a little team supporting a grassroots organization that lived off of grants and stuff, like school districts, only they were conservationists. So I got on the phone to the governor's chief of staff, who had hired me to work as a staff writer for the Democrats, and told him, I mean, I let loose the first short burst, and then I thought, I just told, you can't do this. You have the most efficient model in the state of Washington for getting work done on the field to protect natural resources. This is it. If you take it into, if it gets part of ecology, it'll just be big 3-ring binders on shelves. That's all it can get done.
Mm-hmm.
And, he said, oh, you're a good man. And just didn't, they didn't subsume it. But I think they have since.
Well,
so that's an example of I think I had a skill set, but I also had this, and I don't want to call, I had this condition of, you know, not, of chafing under supervision that isn't helpful. If you're not helping, if you want to lead me, good, but don't push me or hold me back.
Let me ask you, just
lead me or follow me.
Right. Let me ask you just one last question that I have for you, Mr. Akins.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a question that I ask all the Vietnam veterans that I interview, and it's a pretty large question, so please feel free to interpret and answer it how you see fit. But as we look back, you know, these 50 some odd years later or whatever it is, from the Vietnam War, what does it mean? What is the lasting historical legacy of the Vietnam War in your opinion?
Well, Well, invading under other countries doesn't work. War doesn't work. It just creates more problems, especially if you're meddling in somebody else's fight or riding in on your white horse and telling, and black hat, I say, telling people how they're going to run their lives or their government and everything. And if you don't, we'll shoot you or we'll get rid of you or something. This is a mistake. And we haven't learned from our mistakes. And nobody should be his commander-in-chief unless they walk point for a while. Unless they got in the shit.
Yeah.
But we need a war council, not a commander-in-chief. And you have to have theologians. You have to have combat experienced veterans. Nobody that hasn't been in the shit. And you need locals from this area, whatever area you're thinking about invading. So light on the pointy-headed intellectuals and heavy on the experience to make the call to go to war. Because if you foment war, you're going to, I mean, here we are running around paranoid and spend wasting lives and money when we could be and going spiraling downhill. We've lost all our goodwill in major parts of the nation world, and we're doing Iraq. Everybody thought I was crazy because I got upset about an invading Iraq. My son's little league parents thought I was crazy. So they start going, yeah, we got to go in there. And I'm going, no, we don't. And I start getting a little bit, I think they could see it in my eyes. And I'd be talking low and slow and telling it like it is. And they'd be backing up and, like I was crazy.
Mr. Akins, is there anything else you'd like to add to the interview before we bring it to a close?
Well, when you said we had a question, it reminds me of a question a writer had told me, a guy who was, he is a sports psychologist. He played AAA baseball, and when he got cut, he went to Canada and tried out for CFL football.
Hmm.
The athlete. He's a sports psychologist. And he asked me if I could sum up my Vietnam experience in one word. And I told him I couldn't. But one phrase. He goes, what's that? And I go, time of my life. I saw the worst of mankind and I saw the best of mankind.
That's a pretty incredible way to look at it.
Yeah, because I saw people trying, to save each other, and I saw people trying to commit atrocity, So, yeah, I kind of and I had a foot in two worlds. Once I got into CAPS, protecting the innocent and getting bad guys. And these bad guys are just like me. You roll them over, and except for the different facial features and skin tone, they were just like me. And you couldn't think like that for very long, 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Because you had to go through their pockets and find intel and move on. And you had to put your friends on the chopper and give them 5 seconds, and that's it. No more. So, I don't know. You end up with acute and chronic PTSD and manic depressive mental condition, but you're wiser. And I sometimes feel guilt that when I came home, I didn't tell it like it is. I said I would when I was over there. But when I came back, I felt too much shame, too much guilt, a lot of pride in surviving and keeping most of the guys that listened to me alive and well, or alive at home. Don't know if they're well. It was a hard thing to deal with, because I knew the American dream. It's a good dream, but it wasn't for me. If you saw my little house, you'd understand. I mean, to me, it's shelter. It's not a measurement of my success or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, there's nothing on the wall. It's clutter everywhere. Yeah. But anyway, it's been a pleasure talking to you about this, and I think what you're doing is real important. I think it's real invaluable because I wanted to tip you off to Daryl Perryman, D-E-Y-L-E, Daryl Perryman, P-E-R-R-Y-M-A-N. She's in New Mexico, Albuquerque, and he's done a documentary with a neighbor, it turns out, which is named Moises Alou. Moises Alou. That's kind of a baseball name.
Yes, it
the
is.
Alou brothers. The Alou brothers. I watched them play here in Tacoma in AAA. Juan Marichal, too. But anyway, he has a documentary he worked on in his house called Same, Same, But Different.
Mm-hmm.
And he would be a good source for you. And he should have his documentary in your archive.
Well, I'll have to check on that.
Mm-hmm.